Life is shit. Oh sure, there were good bits every few years or so, but most of the time, for most people on the planet, life is boring, stressful, or downright depressing. Mostly there's nothing you or I can do about it. The Boko Harams, the ISISs, the racism and homophobia, the cancer, the Alzheimer's, the earthquakes, the climate change, the scammers, the spammers, the muggers and the bankers. But there are some things we can do. This is a podcast about those little things. The small steps we can take to make life a little bit less shit. I'm going to start, for no particular reason, with the American author Dan Brown. To date, Dan Brown has inflicted 6 novels on the world, but it was only with his third, The Da Vinci Code, that he really started doing damage. Soon after publication in 2003, the book became a worldwide hit, spending more than 2 years on the New York Times bestseller list, and selling, to date, an estimated 80 million copies. It was made into a 2006 film starring Tom Hanks, which took the best part of $1 billion at the box office. And on the back of that book, Brown's earlier books were reprinted and snapped up in their millions. Total sales of Dan Brown's books now stand at well over 200 million. At this point, I feel compelled to issue a warning. If you haven't read any of Dan Brown's books, this podcast does contain spoilers. However, since the main point of this podcast is to deter anyone who was thinking of reading a Dan Brown book from reading a Dan Brown book, and since, for something to be spoiled, it has to have some sort of merit in the first place, it's a warning I issue very lightly. Now, the original idea behind this episode was that I was going to read every Dan Brown book and do a comprehensive hatchet job on all of them. However, it turned out that there was more than enough material in one book alone for a podcast 3 hours long. So today, I shall be talking mostly about Angels and Demons. Angels and Demons was Dan Brown's second novel, published in 2000. It sold fewer than 10,000 copies initially, but thanks to The Da Vinci Code, it belatedly became a bestseller. And like The Da Vinci Code, it was made into a film starring Tom Hanks, which came out in 2009. The film was bad, but it's a towering fucking masterpiece compared with the book. What's so bad about it? Well, let's start where Dan starts, with the author's note that he sticks at the front of the book. References to all works of art, tombs, tunnels, and architecture in Rome are entirely factual. The Brotherhood of the Illuminati is also factual. Now, I don't know exactly what Dan is hoping to gain with this intro. It doesn't add anything to the reading experience. He's just setting himself up for a fall, which he duly takes, because as countless reviewers and bloggers have pointed out, the book is riddled with errors of geography, history, science, art, and Catholic doctrine. Lots of other sites have already listed these exhaustively, so I'll just pick out one or two highlights. In chapter 32, Brown describes the Swiss Guard, the Vatican Police, as the deadliest security force in the world. In fact, they're a largely ceremonial force, and the last time they were involved in any fatal engagements was 1527. In chapter 64, not content with misspelling the name of the Greek mythological character Daedalus, he gets the myth wrong. Daedalus did not find his way out of the labyrinth by keeping his hand on the left wall. He designed the fucking labyrinth. Theseus found his way out of the labyrinth with a ball of twine. There's only one possible reason for that author's note. Dan Brown spent ages doing that research, so he's damn well going to make you read it. But one of the cardinal rules of writing fiction is not to draw attention to your research. The point of research is to do it, then discard most of it. If you crowbar it all in, the reader will be as bored as you were doing it. But Dan just can't help himself. If he's found out a fact, he's going to inflict it on us, pace be damned. In chapter 107, for example, in a scene narrated from Langdon's viewpoint, we have the sentence, "The circular citadel shot skyward 107 feet to the bronze angel above." What human being can estimate heights with that precision? And why the hell would we be interested anyway? Unless Langdon is randomly carrying around a fucking theodolite, he's never in a million years going to tell us that the angel is 107 feet above him. This just rips us out of the fictional world and hurls us tit first into Wikipedia. But at the end of the day, these are minor quibbles. This is escapist fiction, after all. Unfortunately, one of the core skills required for writing escapist fiction is command of the language, which Dan also finds a bit of a challenge. Take his spelling, grammar, and punctuation. In Angels and Demons, he frequently ends questions with an exclamation mark. In chapter 21, he spells canon-like with 2 N's instead of 3. In chapter 36, he uses the word diffuse instead of defuse when referring to a bomb. But it's not just the basics. Dan Brown clearly has a huge fondness for the thesaurus. He'll never use a simple word where an obscure one will do, which results in jarring phrases such as despite his unfortunate appellative and clearly enjoying Langdon's sickening cognition. But apparently he's not quite so keen on the dictionary, because he just doesn't seem to know what some words mean. In Chapter 7, he uses disinterested when he means uninterested. Chapter 11, he writes the Illuminati stronghold on the Masons, instead of the Illuminati stranglehold on the Masons. Chapter 28, her concern for his health was taking a back burner. Things can be put on the back burner, Dan, or they can take a back seat. They can't take a back burner. Chapter 38, we have the phrase, for the tiniest of an instant. Even when his prose isn't out and out wrong, it's invariably ham-fisted. The goodly people over at Language Log label Brown one of the worst prose stylists in the history of literature, and they know whereof they speak. Now, I don't know if anyone else does this, but whenever I read a book, I choose a voice to read it to myself in. And it took me a while to work out what voice to use for Dan Brown. First of all, I thought that gruff, deadly earnest Hollywood trailer voiceover guy, Vittoria's emotions were a cyclone of twisting agonies. Then I thought Tom Hanks, but not Tom Hanks in The Da Vinci Code, Tom Hanks in Forrest Gump.
They accelerated up the manicured road past the squat building marked Radio Vaticana. This, Langdon realized to his amazement, was the hub of the world's most listened to radio programming, Radio Vaticana.
Eventually, I discovered the perfect voice. Chapter 7.
His wheelchair seemed to leap across the tiled floor.
Chapter 61.
She felt the stark reality of the last 8 hours closing in around her.
And when Dan Brown pulls the pin on a metaphor, take cover. All right, I'll stop doing the voice now. Chapter 15.
Six stories, said Cola blankly, like an analytical engine.
Yes, Dan. Analytical engine is sort of a synonym for computer. Except there's no way an analytical engine could speak, because it's the name of the primitive mechanical computer described by Charles Babbage in 1837. If Cola sounded like an analytical engine, he'd be whirring, clunking and blowing out steam. Chapter 29. Langdon's concerned gaze passed through her like a ghost. So, who's on the other side of her that he's concerned about? But my favourite imagery bookends the book. When Langdon sees a fax with the word Illuminati branded on a scientist's body, he reacts thus.
It was like he had been hit by a truck!
Not the most original of similes there, Dan. And again, you've confused like and as if. But we'll forgive you the odd cliché in the heat of the moment. But then, towards the end of the book, after Langdon falls 3 miles from an exploding helicopter into a river without a parachute, we hear that his body felt like it had been run over by a truck. Now, in the first instance, the simile throws some sort of extra light on the situation. It's comparing psychological impact with physical impact. But this is just comparing one example of almost certainly fatal physical trauma with another example of almost certainly fatal physical trauma. It's like telling us someone's been stabbed with a drop point hunting knife and then saying, it felt as though it had been stabbed with a clip point hunting knife. The novel is completely lacking in wit, either from the characters or the narrator, and yet it did have me laughing out loud on several occasions. Chapter 49. The decor in the colonnade was an incongruous mix of waterwool carpets and marble floors. Well, that certainly is an incongruous mix, Dan, albeit quite a hard one to spot, since if the carpets are waterwool, there's no fucking way of telling whether the floors are marble. Early on in the book, we are introduced to a mysterious assassin, who, appropriately enough, is killing someone. But in Brown's attempt to describe him, we learn his reputation for secrecy was exceeded only by that of his deadliness. Now let's try to unpick that. Okay, so we have this bad man, right, about whom we know nothing, other than that he's just killed someone. This sentence, his reputation for secrecy was exceeded only by that of his deadliness, is telling us that this assassin is famed for his deadliness. Well, if I was a cleaner, I'd sure hope I was famed for my cleanliness. But that's not my main gripe. This sentence is also telling us that as well as a reputation for deadliness, the assassin has an only marginally smaller reputation for secrecy. This guy, whose work, one would admittedly hope, often requires discretion, is so discreet that he's famous for it. Just how famous is he for his secrecy, I wonder? World famous? And remember, this is the edited, finished article. Before it appeared in the shops, this manuscript will have passed by at least 4 sets of expert eyes. I've worked in publishing for 22 years, and I know from experience that there's only one reason things get printed with this many mistakes, and that's because originally there were hundreds more. But ho there, sir, you say. Dan Brown's books are thrillers, not works of great literature. We don't expect them to contain painstakingly crafted prose, evocative imagery, innovative use of language, or penetrating insights into the human condition. And indeed, sir, you are right.
The really important ingredients in a good thriller are twisty, imaginative, coherent plots, interesting characters, and fast-paced, high-stakes action. So let's take those in order, shall we? You can't accuse Dan Brown of having small ideas. He certainly never lets up with the jeopardy. However, one of the principal requirements of a plot, even a preposterous one, is that it have some sort of internal logic. And this is where Dan falls down. For starters, he expects us to believe that a brilliant 40-year-old Harvard academic has never heard of the particle accelerator at CERN. In chapter 85, five burly Swiss guards are unable to push the lid off a sarcophagus. Then a few pages later, the deadly assassin tips an entire sarcophagus on top of Langdon as if it's a cardboard box. According to the Oxford Handbook of Roman Sculpture, the average marble sarcophagus weighs 3 to 5 metric tons. And the greatest weight ever lifted by a human being is 500 kilograms, or less than 1/6 of that. In chapter 108, it's the exciting final fight between Langdon and the deadly assassin. And even though there's a life or death struggle in progress, Brown feels obliged to pause and tell us something about the decor. The embellishments in the oblong room, though old and faded, were replete with familiar symbology. Now, I could be wrong, but I think this is the first time any writer has ever bothered to inform me that a room is oblong. Because, you know, that's a really unusual shape for a room. But this narrative decision becomes even odder a page later, when Brown continues. He tried to corner the assassin in the oval room. This damn room has no corners! Well, that's a head-scratcher, Dan, because 15 paragraphs ago you specifically took time out to inform us that it had exactly 4. In chapter 91, there's a convoluted sequence of events set in and around the site of the third murder. The commander of the Swiss Guard lends a gun to Langdon. Before they enter, the commander cocks his weapon. We must assume, though it's not explicitly stated, that this is a second gun. He then goes in and is immediately killed by the assassin, who is unarmed. I mean, I know this guy's reputation for deadliness is greater than even than his reputation for secrecy, but unarmed? Against the commander of the deadliest security force in the world, wielding a semi-automatic pistol? Anyway, so far we have 2 guns, one on Dead Cop, one on Langdon. Langdon lets his companion, Vittoria, take his gun, apparently because he has a moral objection to shooting open locks, and they go inside. The assassin is still unarmed, because he has eschewed the opportunity to take the gun from the body of the Swiss guard. Perhaps he has a moral or aesthetic objection to handguns. Anyway, of the 2 adversaries who've just entered, he decides to take on the one wielding a semi-automatic pistol, and wins again, although he doesn't kill her. He does, however, take her gun, which he then uses to start firing at Langdon. So he doesn't have any objection to guns. He fires at least 10 shots at Langdon and misses with all of them. Deadliness could do with a bit of work there, deadly assassin. And after an exceedingly improbable fight, the assassin flees and Langdon searches the commander's body and only now takes the second gun. Several questions here. Not just why the assassin fails to take Olivetti's gun when he kills him, but why doesn't he have his own gun in the first place? I mean, he's deadly and all, but isn't he just making things needlessly hard for himself? He has no objection to using guns, and his sponsor is clearly a man of significant resources. Surely they could stretch to one fucking firearm. Towards the end of the book, as the countdown to the explosion ticks down, it takes Langdon, Vittoria and the Camerlengo 14 minutes to run through the Basilica to St. Peter's Tomb, where the antimatter canister is located, and 1 minute to run out. Furthermore, the entire plot unravels when you consider one basic fact. The murders of the 4 priests are all supposed to be public for maximum horror. But if it wasn't for Robert Langdon's detective work, no one would ever have known about the first murder because the priest is killed quietly in the basement of a closed church. And the guy who turns out to have orchestrated the whole thing, the Camerlengo, had nothing to do with the hiring of Robert Langdon. In chapter 86, Langdon finds himself trapped in the oxygen-poor Vatican archives after a power cut and desperately needs to break the glass walls. The thing is, the last time we saw him, he had a gun, so he could just shoot his way out. Of course, that wouldn't be exciting enough, so the weapon was gone. Olivetti had relieved him of it in the Pope's office, saying he did not want loaded weapons around with the Camerlengo present. Well, maybe, Dan, if you'd just written this actual episode into the previous scene, you wouldn't have to engage in outrageous backsplaining now. But then, at the end of the day, it's just a bit of fun. Not everything has to make perfect sense. The really important thing is that each scene is fast-paced and exciting, right? That the book is a page-turner. Well, yes. But Dan has a bit of trouble there, too. The action in Angels and Demons takes place over 19 hours, and the book is 150,000 words long. To give that some context, A Tale of Two Cities is 137,000 words long, and the action in that takes place over 17 years, which makes A Tale of Two Cities 8,600 times more fast-paced than Angels and Demons. What takes Brown so long? Let's look at some examples. The whole of chapter 29, two pages, is devoted to Cola's secretary debating whether or not to call him on the intercom. In chapter 67, it takes Langdon two pages to descend a ladder. In chapter 100, it takes Dan Brown seven paragraphs to explain that cross, as well as being a poetic shortening of the word across, also means cross. Seven paragraphs. Page turner? Page burner, more like. So, what about the characters? If Dan Brown is forever telling us the bleeding obvious, it shouldn't come as any great surprise that his characters are guilty of the same sin. Just about every individual in this book is the sort of person you sidle away from at parties. They can't think of a single thing to say apart from what's directly in front of their face. No witty remarks, no interesting insights or opinions, and God forbid any Tarantino-esque banter. They are, to a man, weapons-grade imbeciles. In chapter 25, Vittoria, despite having worked at CERN for years and despite being a genius, is surprised when her mobile phone doesn't work 50 metres underground. In chapter 109, the crowds gathered in St. Peter's Square, despite warnings that there's an antimatter bomb that could very well kill them all, and even though it's all being televised live and they could all watch from the safety of their own homes, refused to disperse. 45 minutes to detonation. Plenty of time to watch, they all apparently think, at the same time. Yes, plenty of time to watch half the city not blowing up. After which, the city will blow up, possibly killing them all. Basically, Brown is trying to ratchet up the tension by putting more lives at risk. The trouble is, Dan, if all the lives at risk are all complete fuckwits, then we really don't care. In chapter 88, the mysterious Janus is giving the assassin some instructions, during the course of which he issues an unusual order.
Make sure you escape. Alive.
He actually says those words with his mouth. Maybe the guy's reputation's got him worried.
Try not to be too deadly in case you accidentally kill yourself.
The questions the characters ask are even dumber. After the briefing about the massive bomb in Vatican City, one of the Swiss guards asks,
What happens if we don't find it in time?
I'm afraid that's just one of life's unanswerable questions, mate. When a doctor finds Langdon unconscious in the river after his 3-mile plunge from the helicopter, he thinks,
Only minutes ago, he'd seen this man get into a helicopter and fly miles up into the air. How could this be the same man?
Oh, beats me, Doc. There's literally not a single possible explanation of how a person can get from the sky to the ground in just a few minutes. The bit part players in books are often stupid. What about our hero, Robert Langdon? Well, the author tells us that he's handsome, effortlessly cool, witty, popular with the students, and then proceeds to describe the most stultifyingly dull, pigeon-brained, witless charisma vacuum you could ever wish to avoid. In chapter 112, while running through the Vatican's catacombs with a torch, Langdon has a lightbulb moment. He began to fear what the place would look like if the light went out, writes Dan Brown. Well, I don't know about you, Dan, but black! Well, fetch me a cold compress and a comfy chair. And twice, in the Fountain of the Four Rivers and in the Illuminati Lair, Langdon approaches the assassin with the advantage of surprise. The only advantage he will ever have against a man whose reputation for secrecy is exceeded only by that of his deadliness. And twice, he throws it away. The first time, he shouts, Don't move! And the second time, Get away from her! I've got a good way of getting him away from her, Rob. Kill the twat! In a 2013 interview in The Scotsman, Dan Brown said, and I quote, Robert Langdon is much more interesting and intelligent than I am. Well, given that Robert Langdon has the intellect of a tadpole and all the charisma of a wet fart, you'd better pray to God Almighty that you never get trapped in a lift with Dan Brown. But if Dan Brown is such a spectacularly bad writer at every possible level, how do we explain his success? 200 million books. Let's say that's 80 million people who've read at least one Dan Brown book. Surely 80 million people can't be wrong. Well, here's the thing. There's a common error of reasoning that logicians call the argumentum ad populum, or consensus fallacy. Simply put, this means to conclude that something is right or true because a large number of people believe it to be true. And, as the name suggests, it's a fallacy. The fact is, any number of people can be wrong. Let's take some examples. In World War II, the combined population of the Axis powers was 264 million people. So that's 264 million people who were wrong. As of today, there are around 1.6 billion Muslims and 2.2 billion Christians. They sure as hell can't all be right. So that's at least 1.6 billion, or 2.2 billion, or more likely 3.8 billion, more people who are wrong. So numbers are no defence, Dan. However, we're still faced with the fact that an awful lot of people actually enjoy Dan Brown's books. What do they find so appealing? Well, it is true that this whole idea of religious symbology, of sects and cults and myths and historical puzzles, are relatively new ground in fiction. Apart from the Indiana Jones films, of course, which did it about 1,000 times better, even the fourth one. And the 1982 book called The Holy Blood and the Holy Grail, from which Brown lifted most of the ideas in The Da Vinci Code. But with the big themes, the exotic locations and the academic slant, his books do at least, in theory, sound fun. But I think I've identified the main trick Brown employs to get people to turn pages. As we've already seen, Dan Brown's books are generally plodding, leaden, and utterly devoid of irony or subtlety. But Brown creates the illusion of excitement by peppering his prose liberally with excitement words. When things actually happen, in between the catatonic passages of description and banal reflection, everything is turned up to 11. Every engine roars into life. Every car speeds or tears or rockets or thunders. Every action occurs suddenly or instantly or is unbelievable or unfathomable. The words impossible and impossibly occur 42 times in Angels and Demons. And his characters are permanently flabbergasted. Every single revelation for them, no matter how telegraphed or laboriously worded, is utterly beyond belief. Barely a page goes by without someone being stunned or dazed or shocked or amazed or awestruck or thunderstruck. So instead of actually describing events in a genuinely exciting way, Brown just throws in words that tell us it's exciting, which apparently is enough for some people. So if any of those people are listening right now, this podcast is hilarious, moving, and unbelievably intelligent. Now, you might be wondering why, of all the terrible things going on in this world, I've singled out Dan Brown for criticism. After all, his books are just escapism. Why am I getting so worked up about them? Now, as some of you may know, and some of you may have perhaps divined, I have in the past harboured writing ambitions of my own. I can imagine that some of you, therefore, might say you're just bitter. Well, that's categorically untrue. I'm also puzzled, furious, incredulous, bewildered, disaffected, disappointed, disenchanted, dispirited, discouraged, depressed, discontent, dissatisfied, and fucked off. So just bitter doesn't really cover it. See, I have absolutely nothing against lowbrow entertainment. We all like a bit of no-effort stimulation every now and then. I just don't see why lowbrow has to mean low quality. I don't expect everything to be strictly grammatically correct or entirely plausible or completely original. But I do expect vaguely interesting characters and for the words and the action to make some kind of basic sense. Just because I've turned my brain off for a bit doesn't mean I want it insulted. Of course, Dan Brown isn't the only culprit. There are thousands of god-awful writers out there. I'm looking at you, E.L. James. What bothers me about Brown in particular is the scale of his success. 200 million books. That's the population of Brazil. Dan Brown has an estimated personal fortune of $400 million. When someone becomes that successful, people want to emulate them. So there are actually writers out there now who aspire to be Dan Brown. Writers who aspire to write passages like, "The van pulled up to the fountain." Langdon felt an uneasy premonition. Had the Hassassin arrived early? Had he come in a van? It means publishers are now actively looking for writers of clumsy, repetitive prose, cardboard characters and plots that don't make any sense. Every time a Dan Brown book sells, that means a book by a more talented, deserving writer isn't being bought. There are hundreds, thousands of fantastic writers out there who are more likely to remain unread, uncelebrated, unloved, because all that's on display in W.H. Smith is the latest steaming turd from Dan Brown. But Andy, you say, you're not exactly the first person to have a go at Dan Brown. Isn't he a bit of an easy target? Hasn't he been mocked enough? Well, no, because it hasn't changed anything, has it? As long as Dan Brown is still writing books, as long as Dan Brown is still living in his $75 million New Hampshire home, then no, he hasn't been mocked enough. The day Dan Brown has to forage for clothes in a skip and wear a sandwich board in the middle of Times Square saying, "I admit it, I can't write, please buy me some soup," that is the day Dan Brown will have been mocked enough. So my message today is threefold. Firstly, I'd like to say to Dan himself, please stop writing. Every cack-handed sentence you complete impoverishes the English language a little bit more. If you absolutely must continue to desecrate logic and prose and the concept of drama, self-publish in very small print runs and inflict them only on those close to you. And even then, before you publish, at least get someone to read some of your sentences back to you. Since Dan Brown is unlikely to be falling over himself to grant the wish of a bitter, bald, middle-aged, failed comedian in person, I'd like to extend my plea to those who have any influence over him. His family, his friends, his agent. In a recent interview, Dan said he had 12 more ideas for books featuring Robert Langdon. He's only 50. He might actually pull it off. 12 more morasses of trite, nonsensical, overblown, turgid wank. Please, please do all that's in your power to prevent him from setting pen to paper again. Persuade him to take on a new challenge, like UN ambassador to South Sudan. You may feel a sense of obligation to him, but your duty to humanity is greater. And finally, I'd like to appeal to you, the average reader. Don't buy any more Dan Brown books. If you see a Dan Brown book prominently displayed in a bookshop, hide it. Give another writer his or her day in the sun. Maybe one who has English as a first language. And if you ever see someone reading a Dan Brown book on a train or a bus, set fire to it. Or if you haven't got a lighter, narrow your eyes and gently shake your head. Well, that's the end of the first installment of Rainbows and Lollipops. Do you have any of your own bugbears, pet hates, that you'd like me to talk about? Do send them in, and I'll most likely completely ignore them, because most people's opinions suck. If you have any constructive criticism about the podcast, fuck off, you interfering know-all. And if you wish to pursue litigation on the basis of something said in this podcast, bring it on. I am completely out of fucks, and I guarantee you, you have more to lose than I do. Before I go, I'd like to thank all the people who made this podcast possible. Amy McSimpson, who made the charmingly depressing artwork for the website. Cyana, a criminally under-supported band from South London, who made the charmingly depressing theme tune. And Matt Hill, without whose consummate technical prowess, this podcast would sound even worse than it does. This won't be a particularly regular thing, because it's shitloads of work, and it doesn't pay anything, and I do still actually have some semblance of a life. But if and when I do release the next one, please tune in. And remember,
make sure you escape alive.